The Long Knives Are Crying, a novel by Joseph M. Marshall III, Chapter 16, The Broken Arrow. A lone figure stood atop the windswept plateau, oblivious to the wind and the ants crawling among the sagebrush and over his feet. What kind of good fortune or mean twist of fate had brought him here, he didn't know, and he didn't care. He had been meant to find this place. He ignored the bones of the big man after recovering from the initial shock of finding the two skeletons. Coyotes and buzzards and the elements themselves have stripped of all the flesh, but there was no doubt about who they were, or had been. Old Coyote had suspected for months that his younger sister and her husband had gotten themselves in trouble somewhere deep in Lakota country. His white brother-in-law had been determined to collect Lakota scalps and would not listen to anyone advising caution, perhaps because he feared no one. He was the biggest man anyone had ever seen, and he had the strength to go with his size, and perhaps a foolish sense of invincibility as well. The fact that the big man was dead was a warning. Somehow, someone had killed him. No one stood a chance against him fighting hand to hand, and the bullet hole in his skull suggested the encounter was not that. Whoever killed him had figured the odds probably almost immediately. The smashed rifle was a puzzle, however, as was the fact that the bullets were still in their bags. Rifles and bullets were always coveted prizes. The killer had smashed the rifle, and he did not take the bullets. Old Coyote didn't know the name of the man who had killed his sister and her husband, but it was a Lakota. Of that he was absolutely certain. There were two weathered arrows with his sister's bones. He reached down and grabbed the broken shaft of one. It was a war arrow, with only two goose feathers. In the space between the feathers was a mark faded by the weather, but the faint red and black lines were still visible. One Lakota warrior and only one used those marks on his arrow. Old Coyote would search for that man. He had time. Likely the man who had killed his sister and her husband would not know that someone would come for him, so there was time for revenge. He didn't care about the white man, his brother-in-law. Old Coyote laid the blame on him. If the man would have come back alone, he would have killed him. Without a twinge of regret, he would leave his bones behind. The important thing was that he had found his sister's bones. He would gather them up and take her home to his mother and father so they could bury her properly. Old Coyote rode away from the plateau, his sister's bones and the bag he had fashioned from a gray blanket. He would travel as fast as he could to his village, half a day north of the Yellowstone River. Several days before, he had watched a line of people, Lakota people, moving camping heading east. Perhaps they were looking for buffalo as his people were, but they must have found nothing. There were no more buffalo. But wherever the Lakota were going, he would return and follow them. In his hand was a piece of shaft with the faint markings beneath the feathers. He rolled the broken arrow between his fingers as he rode. Cloud helped guide the last small group of horses into a valley between two low hills where the grass was good. He estimated that there were nearly 1,000 head in all. A small creek flowed between the hills, and once the guards were in place around them, the horses would settle down. Farther down the valley to the south, the camp of more than 200 lodges were already in place. According to Yellow Wolf, there were at least 3 days from the White Buttes. He and Fast Horse had scouted and laid out a general route. Food was an issue, however. At least 8 deer or 4 elk were needed to feed nearly 1,000 people every day. In the past, fish was only an occasional delicacy, but now fish traps were placed in every stream at every opportunity. Prairie dogs, rabbits, squirrels, and grouse were regular fare as well. While seeing to the rigors and tasks of everyday life, the people moved steadily toward the White Buttes, toward what they hoped was an answer to the problem of the encroachment of whites, toward the time when the buffalo might shake the earth again and the ruts left by the intrusive wagon wheels would be forgotten and grown over. But they had to eat and stay strong, so hunters were going and coming constantly. It was decided that they would camp here for 2 or 3 days so the hunters could find fresh meat. Cloud dismounted and led his horse to the top of a rise above the herd to gaze at the animals that filled the meadow. They were a palette of colors against the greening earth, grays, sorrels, bays, buckskins, blacks, and brown and white, black and white, and yellow and white paints, with roans thrown in for accent. But they were more than colorful expressions. They were the symbol of a relationship with the Lakota that was just as critical and defining as the relationship the Lakota had with the buffalo. For Cloud, galloping over the land on the back of a graceful, powerful horse was the closest he felt he would come to flying. Even now, as he heard the rhythmic pounding of hooves and turned to watch a group of boys racing their mounts over a hill, He could almost feel their exhilaration and joy. Then Cloud turned instantly and instinctively toward a movement he caught out of the corner of his eye. Taken Alive was quick to wave as he saw his friend's attitude of alertness, like a wolf ready to spring. Across the back of the pack horse he was leading was draped the carcass of a black-tailed deer. "I know ribs are your favorite, so I'll drop some off at your lodge," he said to Cloud. "We are grateful," Cloud replied, acknowledging his friend's generosity. "Last evening I heard the omen say to our headman that we should rest for 2 or 3 days," Taken Alive informed him. "That would be good, because there is a valley to the north of here, and it is full of blacktails. Maybe we could go after more of them before dawn." "I am ready for a good hunt," Cloud replied, "a chance to use the bow Little Bird made for me." "Good," Taken Alive exclaimed, urging his horses down the slope. "My wife and I will skin and quarter this carcass and bring the ribs over to your lodge." Dawn found them north of the camp in the valley Taken Alive had found the day before. They were waiting in a stand of blue spruce as the growing light slowly defined the landscape. They had rubbed themselves down liberally with sage to cover their human scent, and along with water, they had brought peppermint tea to cover their breath. They stood next to their horses, their bows already strung, quivers tied to the front of their waists and six-shooters tucked into their belts. No conversation was necessary for the experienced hunters. If no black-tailed deer appeared in the area, they would simply move on to another likely spot. They kept an eye on the terrain they could see, knowing that their horses would see, hear, or smell any other creature before they would. Soon both horses looked to the left. Taken Alive had not overstated the situation. Through the trees, the hunters saw three large doe walking into the head of the narrow valley, browsing lazily on new shoots of grass. If the doe stayed on the valley floor, they would cross in front of the waiting hunters. The hunters had not randomly picked the stand of spruce. The fresh scent of the trees would cover their human odor, and the trees themselves would hide them and the horses. Also, they were looking down a slight incline into a small meadow that was thick with new grass, the type of secluded area deer liked. Their position gave them a perfect shooting lane. A lifetime of hunting, literally beginning in their father's and grandfather's footsteps, had taught them things that now were instinctual. Like any predator, most of their actions were carried out without conscious thought. With hand signs, Taken Alive indicated that Cloud should take the first shot. With unhurried and deliberate movements, Cloud placed an arrow on the bowstring while Taken Alive got down low and crawled under his horse's belly to the other side, so that it was between him and the approaching deer. He knocked his arrow and stayed down on one knee. Cloud noted that none of the doe had any fawns with them, and the udders of all three were not full. A herd of old doe, he guessed. Eventually, they were at the bottom of the gentle slopes below the hunters. Taken Alive was hidden between the horses, and Cloud was kneeling behind a sopley that hid him effectively. Not so much as a breath of wind stirred the grass. As blacktails are in the habit of doing, the doe lifted their heads frequently to look around. One spotted the horses and stared for several long moments, put her head down to graze, and immediately looked up again. Satisfied that the horses were no threat, she seemed to settle down. Cloud decided that there was no better opportunity for a shot, since she was about 30 paces away. Smoothly, he pulled and released. As much as he had practiced with his new hunting bow, he was still surprised at how fast the arrow flew. At the same instant, he heard a hollow thud. The doe jumped sideways, then dashed frantically away. Behind her, from the corner of his eye, Cloud saw another doe spin, then sprint up the slope. Taken Alive had taken a shot, he realized. The remaining doe bounded over the ridge and was gone. Cloud's doe had gone east and crossed over two ridges. He found her in a thicket and dismounted to bleed and gut the carcass after tying a bundle of sage in the branches of the snakeberry bushes. He washed off his hands after he finished and sat on the crest of the gully to wait. He was ever alert, because the demeanor of the warrior was every bit as instinctual as the habits of the hunter. He watched the distant skylines all around. From a far hill he heard the thin bark of a coyote, and from somewhere beyond a distant ridge came the drumming of the sharp-tailed grouse as it performed its courtship dance. Spring was a time of renewal, and he hoped that the journey to meet Sitting Bull at the White Buttes would bring renewal for them all. At the sound of hooves softly scraping against the ground, Cloud's hand went to the handle of his six-shooter. Taken Alive whistled as he rode to the crest, leading the pack horse carrying his deer. They quickly loaded and tied down Cloud's doe and were headed home before mid-morning. By the middle of the day, they were within sight of the herd of broodmares. Many of them had already given birth, so dozens of long-legged colts were suckling their mothers or testing their legs with quick sprints. A pair of teenage horse guards waved as they passed. Although the air was still cool, the boys were dressed only in leggings, breechcloths, and moccasins. Taken alive, and Cloud smiled. It was good to see that the hopefulness and eagerness of the boys was alive and well. Another pair of eyes had also been watching their horse herd and trained a long glass on the two hunters as it passed in front of him. Old Coyote had spent the night crawling to the top of a saltweed-covered knob, swathed in grass and twigs from head to toe. He blended into the crust of the knob and hoped he had not unwittingly found an anthill. His only weapons were a knife and a six-shooter. Lakota men wore their bows and quivers across the small of their backs when they were not actively on the hunt or engaged in battle. Old Coyote concentrated on the tops of the quivers of both men, specifically on the partially exposed feathers of their arrows. The men were moving past him at no more than 30 paces away. The one leading the pack horse carrying two deer carcasses had yellow markings on his arrows. He focused on the other man, but he could only see the tops of the arrows. Old Coyote bit his lip in disappointment. For 6 days he had been shadowing this encampment on the move. There were perhaps 1,000 people or more, he estimated, and as many horses. They were traveling east. Each night he positioned himself so that he could observe the group as they passed by the next morning. 2 days ago he had been nearly trampled by horses, but fortunately they had walked around the clump of sharp soapweeds where he had hidden. There were no other Lakota camps in the area. Several winter camps had been along the Tongue River north of the plateau where he had found his sister's body. Those camps had obviously gathered and were heading east. He would follow as long as he needed to. He was certain that his sister's killer was here, somewhere. Days ago he had ridden south within half a day of the Tongue River with his cousin Singing Elk, who had gone back north with the horses. Old Coyote had decided to go it alone, because he didn't want to put up with anyone else's attitudes or shortcomings. Also, it was easier to hide and become a shadow when alone and on foot. But he suddenly realized the truth of his grandfather's words, that revenge was a lonely path. Nevertheless, he was prepared to stay with it until he found the man he was looking for, or until they found him. His parents' grief was too painful for him to let his sister's death go unpunished. If there was a way to kill her worthless husband twice, he would do it. The worst he could do to him was to leave his bones where they had fallen and deny him a proper burial. There was no certainty of success that all would turn out the way he wanted. Only one thing was for certain. Old Coyote would stick with his task until it came to an end. Someone would die. Fortune had favored him slightly when all the Lakota camps along the Tongue River had gathered themselves and headed east. The two hunters rode up a slight incline and his glass passed over the carcasses hanging on the pack horse. A slight flash of color caught his eye. He moved the glass back and saw the feathered end of an arrow protruding from the side of a carcass. There was a small spot of red between the feathers. Cloud and Taken Alive were not the only hunters who had been successful. A steady stream of men leading loaded pack horses came home throughout the day and into the evening. Women took over as their hunters brought home the meat. They quickly and skillfully skinned and cut up the carcasses. Hundreds of meat racks sprang up all over the village as chunks of meat from hindquarters were sliced into long, thin strips to air dry. Entire sides of ribs were roasted over fire pits with thick beds of hot coals. As the sun went down, a festive atmosphere rose with the enticing odor of roasting meat. A few drums sang here and there, blending with the ringing laughter of children. Around the horse herds, the guards looked longingly towards the village and anxiously waited for their relief to come so they could join in the feasting. A warm, pleasant spring day turned into a cool evening, which was no deterrent for a people that spent most of their lives outside. Families gathered around the outside cooking fires, reluctant to let the day end. Grandmothers told stories until little ones nodded off to sleep in their father's or mother's arms. In the council lodge, Crazy Horse sat with the old men. Although they were traveling through territory that the Lakota considered theirs, there had rarely been large encampments here. The harvests of deer and a few elk had been unexpected, so the old men decided that a few more days of hunting to fill the meat containers would be good for the spirits of the people, as well as for their stomachs. Not to mention that a day or two more of rest and grazing would be good for the horses as well, since grass was plentiful. The ripples of laughter and the soft pounding of drums and the spontaneous celebration of a good day was reassuring to the old men. It was a sure sign that the people still had the ability to make the best of what life put before them. To a man, they all hoped and prayed often that the buffalo would return. In the meantime, life had to go on. "I think the Hunkpapa people will send a scout or two ahead," Black Shield commented as he set aside his bowl of soup. "We should do that too," Grable nodded in agreement. "I was thinking the same," he said. "If no one is there yet, they can leave a sign or wait. They will probably do the same." "It will be good to see them," Worm mused, "to hear how life has been for them, but mostly to be in the company of people who think like we do." Worm's sentiments were not lost on Two Moons, who still blamed himself for the losses his people had suffered at the hands of the Long Knives not 2 months past. Why he ever thought white people, especially Long Knives, could be trusted to act honorably was a question that would bother him the rest of his life. Vivid memories of that dawn attack near the Powder River haunted him every day, especially since some of the wounded had been children. "I hope the Hunkpapa headman has the answer," he said. "These white people have been a scourge too long. They showed what they were made of at the Washita River when they killed women and children and slaughtered all of those horses. And again at Sand Creek, going on 4 years ago now. Thinking of those times wounds the heart all over again." The Cheyenne headman sighed and glanced quickly at the somber faces around him. "If my young men and He Dog and his young men had not fought back the way they did, we probably would have had to bury more of our people than we did. Or maybe they would have killed us all. I will never think kindly of white people again. So that is why I say I hope the Hunkpapa headman has the answer. Whatever it is, I will fight and I will die making it happen." "We are all in this together, my friend," High Eagle reminded the Cheyenne. "Our people have been allies for a long time, long enough for us to speak one another's languages. Now there are children and grandchildren who have Lakota and Cheyenne blood flowing in their veins, as well as the blood of the Blue Clouds. I myself think the only way we can be defeated is to forget that we are friends. Like you, I look forward to what Sitting Bull has to say, but somehow I think it will be to remind us of things we already know. I think he will say that standing shoulder to shoulder and back to back is what we need to do in one way or another." The old men talked away the evening of good and bad times past, of victories won and battles lost. They spoke not to lament, but to remind one another of the roads they had traveled and the strength and wisdom they had gained. In the cool of the evening, a man led a horse slowly, deliberately among the lodges. He wore the shirt of a Cheyenne warrior and the hairstyle as well. Like everyone else, he seemed to be caught up in the lightheartedness of the evening, smiling and nodding as he went. At one cooking fire, he took a succulent rim from a woman, nodded his thanks, and went on. He had slipped into the horse herd just after sundown, after he had changed into a Cheyenne shirt and braided his hair in the manner of a Cheyenne warrior. A horse guard's inquisitive look had been waved away nonchalantly as he found an old mare without a colt. His only fear was that someone would recognize the horse. But what was life unless one took risks now and then? The smattering of Cheyenne was all he knew, and he could probably explain that the mare had gotten loose. Of Lakota he knew nothing except to recognize names. But that was of no consequence to him now. It was only a matter of time before he found what he was looking for. The Cheyenne lodges were of no interest to him. His sister's killer had been a Lakota, and he had already passed by almost half of the Lakota lodges. He had spent the evening wandering about in no particular pattern, not wanting to look too obvious in case someone were to notice him. Turning down yet another row of lodges, he cast a quick glance at the willow tripod standing to the right of a door to a lodge in the second row from the outside and stopped. Old Coyote's heart pounded as he paused to stroke the mare's neck, then bent low as if checking her leg. His gaze settled on the tops of the arrows protruding from the quiver hanging from the tripod. Straightening, he stepped closer to the tripod, reached over carefully, and pulled one of the arrows out slightly, just enough to see the painted crest beneath the feathers. From his belt, he slipped out the broken arrow he had found among his sister's bones and held it next to the other. The markings were the same, exactly the same. He had been incredibly lucky. He had not expected to find the matching arrow for the red and black crest so quickly. Furthermore, no one was home at this lodge, so he was able to look at the arrows without being detected. Looking around, he made up his mind quickly. All around him were his enemies, and any one of the men, Cheyenne or Lakota, would not hesitate to kill him if they found him out. Yet part of him reveled in the moment. Living life on the edge, to the point of taunting death, was what he had been born to do. The Lakota and Cheyenne warriors in the village would understand that. Past the outer row of lodges, he stopped and took a seat on the ground, letting the horse stand behind him. From his pouch, Old Coyote took strands of cord and began to braid them. He would sit here for a while working on his rope. Sooner or later, someone would return to the lodge where the red and black crested arrows hung in the quiver on the tripod. He had seen the hunter this morning, but judging from the size of the lodge, that hunter had a family. Sweetwater Woman helped her mother, Star Woman, take the meat down from the large rack outside and move it to the one inside the lodge for the night. Several thin strips were drying on a trellis rack high above the coals over the inside fire pit. Song helped carry some of the meat, then settled against a chair to watch her mother and grandmother hang the strips of meat from long, thin rods, then tie the rods holding the meat high on the lodge poles. They were still working when Bareface returned from the council lodge. "Are the old men still talking?" Star Woman teased her husband. "No," he replied, a twinkle in his eye. "There is too much good meat to eat, but the feeling is we will stay here for 2 more days. "Good," his wife replied. "I won't sleep past dawn tomorrow, and we could dry this meat so it will not spoil inside the containers." "Granddaughter," Bareface said to Song, "did you get enough to eat, or are you still hungry, like me?" "I ate ribs," the girl replied, returning the smile. "Listening to all those old men makes me hungry," he said, looking around for food. "Your grandfather just wants a reason to eat," the Star Woman went on. Sweetwater Woman helped her mother braid sweetgrass. "We should go home. I want to make stew for Song's father." "Yes," the older woman agreed. "As soon as the sun comes out tomorrow, I will hang the meat outside. You can take your share tomorrow evening. It will be well on its way to drying by then." The drums had stopped and people were settling down for the night. For yet another time, he unraveled the cord and started braiding again, when a movement caught his eye. Looking up, he saw a woman and a girl return to the lodge. The woman took down the shield, the lance, and the bow and arrows from the tripod and went inside. And that concludes chapter 16.